Chapter 6, Macrobiotica. What is this yin-yang, anyway? To make sense of this chapter, I'll have to give a little background about macrobiotics. This is not a diet. It's a philosophy that is applied to diet, among other things, based on founder George Ozawa's personal interpretation of yin-yang analysis and developed by his pupils. The traditional Chinese version of yin and yang is very different. Yin and yang are tendencies that are antagonistic and complementary, and in the extremes, change into their opposite. According to Ozawa, expansion is more yin, contraction yang. Space is yin, time is yang. Cold is yin, hot is yang. Water is yin, salt is yang. Darkness is yin, brightness is yang. And finally, females are more yin and men more yang. Needless to say, yang is considered superior to yin for health, vitality, strength, wisdom, and power. Men can have many women as a sign of their virility, but women should be faithful to one man. Women are not well treated in this cult, although they do get to do a lot of kitchen work. Put them on a pedestal and hand them a broom. It gets very complicated and self-contradictory when applied to real situations. Thankfully, there's always somehow an explanation for the analysis not working, because yin can change to yang. And besides, complaint is symptomatic of a disease and thus a crime against the order of the universe. All disease is a sign of inferiority and is the fault of the person afflicted. So, dissent is considered very negatively, even when it's based on reality and would correct serious error. In Japan, the nail that sticks up is hammered down. Macrobiotics also picks up the severe racism that is endemic in the Japanese culture. According to the literature, genes are made from food, so genes respond to food quality. The best food is whole grains, and the best grain is rice. Thus, those cultures with many generations of rice eating are genetically superior to those with other dietary histories, and the most inferior are from tropical climates ill-suited to cereal grains. That every step of the argument is easily proven false makes no difference, since the cult is based on the intuition of the founders, not on any evidence. Things get stranger the deeper one goes into macrobiotics. For instance, there is the doctrine of signatures, an ancient European superstition that herbs or food that resemble parts of the body can treat ailments for that part of the body. Thus, to be smart, eat cauliflower. Corn kernels look kind of like hearts, so corn is good for heart trouble. And for a long nose, eat bananas. However, this goes both ways. Bananas that we get in a supermarket do not produce seeds. Thus, eating them is supposed to make you sterile. Quite frankly, if I were writing this fantasy, bananas would make men better endowed. That and a couple of kiwi fruits. And give the ladies melons. While macrobiotic counselors give medical advice on all disorders, even those they know nothing about, the most important medical claim has been that macrobiotics cures cancer. Michio Kushi said that the diet cures all cancers, case closed. Later, his wife and daughter died of cancer, and in 2004, he had surgery to remove colon cancer that came within a day of killing him. The cancer cure was a major factor in my getting involved, as a very large proportion of my family and ancestors have had cancer. Macrobiotics does not accept the germ theory of infectious disease, and Louis Pasteur is described in the literature as a great criminal. I had conversations with a macrobiotic friend who insisted that AIDS was not caused by HIV or any virus, which I found ridiculous and dangerous. I wondered if any of the big teachers would consent to getting an injection of HIV or bubonic plague bacteria. Dairy food is strictly avoided. In 1971, Herman Ihara, a student of Ozawa based in California, introduced COCO, a non-dairy baby formula. After several infants had to be hospitalized, it became clear that the formula could induce kwashiorkor, a form of protein malnutrition leading to permanent brain damage, which in turn leads to believing in the doctrine of signatures. Ozawa described several stages of diet, starting with a rather wide food choice, becoming more and more restricted until the final ideal stage of 100% brown rice. This terminal stage is, in fact, fatal. To justify this extremity, macrobiotics includes biological transmutation, where an organism is supposed to be able to change one element into another. That way, you don't need to eat what you need to survive. Ozawa himself smoked heavily and enjoyed cheesecake, donuts, Coca-Cola, coffee, Guinness stout, and Scotch whiskey. At the time I was involved, most macrobiotic leaders smoked, since Ozawa said it yangized the lungs, implying it dried them, made them less flexible, and shrank their capacity. Evidently, the goal was emphysema. Ozawa had a macrobiotic center in New York City, but it was forced to close in 1965 after the death of a woman from malnutrition. Michio Kushi then opened his various operations in Boston. I said, Peru or bust! Leaving Denton for Good, Part 3. I stayed with Terence for a month. As I had almost no money, he let me sleep in his garage for free. There was no door or screen, and we lived on a drainage canal, so the mosquitoes were ferocious. But it was out of the weather, mostly. In the first week of June 1977, I joined with three friends to explore Big Bend. This is a huge national park at the elbow of Texas, where the Rio Grande makes, well, a big bend. One friend was Zeke, a short, wide-shouldered weightlifter who'd blown out his knees in the gym, rendering his fitness frequently useless. The other two were the Sterling brothers, Bill and Ed. Bill was finishing up a BS in physics, which I found most impressive. When I needed an amp for my electric piano to power headphones and run on a battery, he designed the circuit, etched a board in acid, wired up the components, and there it was. Whenever I tried putting together a circuit from a schematic, it looked like a rat's nest and did little except emit toxic smoke and the occasional spark. 30 years later, I specialized in putting together experiments that were intended to create smoke and sparks, thus playing to my strengths. Ed was a jack of all trades, shortly to serve in the Coast Guard for 4 years, and was just the guy to have along in far-flung adventures. His quixotic streak served him well later in his career as a lawyer in Austin. We rented an old pickup truck, put a large plastic garbage can in the back full of water, crammed ourselves in the front seat, despite Zeke's shoulders, and drove 650 miles to the park. We put on another 650 miles inside the park during the next week. I was very impressed. We drank well over a gallon of water a day and hardly urinated. Down by the river, it reached 115 degrees, and swimming in the river was shockingly cold, except for the superb hot springs. I was amazed by the sheer cliffs and stunning vistas, and the climate, for which beer was the only acceptable antidote. On one of our forays to the river in an out-of-the-way location, we noted Mexicans on the other bank. and a man on a horse rode toward us. About halfway across, he stopped and started shooting his rifle into the air. We got the message and split. On the road heading out, we passed a pickup truck that also was light blue and looked very much like ours, heading to the river. A little further along, we passed a cop car going the same way. Glad we missed that little drama. After driving the truck back to Denton, I still had to get to Peru. Terence and I took a 24-hour train ride to Chicago to attend an international meditation conference in one of the big hotels. Many spiritual leaders were there, including Michio Kushi, the most famous of the macrobiotic leaders. The event was hosted by Swami Rama and his Himalayan Institute and included Satchitananda and Purvlight Inayat Khan. Terence had friends in Evansville who put us up for the 3 days of the event. When Michio saw me with no hair and Terence with his now more modest red beard and bright blue turban, he thought, "How can I help these very strange people?" His first step was humiliation. He gave a talk at a local YMCA, and Terence and I tagged along. The crowd was colorful, including hecklers from the local raw food community. They shouted things like, "Cooking kills the life force in food," and "Marijuana is a healthful herb." One fellow had his hair partially shaved, samurai style, but the macho effect was muted by his billowing dress and makeup. Michio called me up to the stage and asked me a series of questions. I answered that I was born in Texas, booze, was 6 feet 2 inches tall, booze, and was a musician, booze. All of this is on the yin side and therefore inferior. Next, he called up a woman who answered that she was short, cheers, born in Chicago of Polish stock, cheers, and worked in manual labor, cheers. All this is on the yang side and thus superior. I was shocked but compliant. This is a standard tactic for cult leaders when they have a new recruit. Later at this conference, I asked Michio about a hearing problem I had that made my voice sound very loud and made speaking difficult. He said it was from mucus congestion, and I should eat a little fruit and fish 3 or 4 times a week. Actually, it was from emaciation, as I was down to about 120 pounds and still losing weight. My Eustachian tubes were hanging open from simple lack of tissue resulting from malnutrition. I had to wait 30 years before having a correct diagnosis. I was very tired from all the activity and needed a place to lie down. Chicago is not very sympathetic to people who need a nap. I found an out-of-the-way place in the hotel and stretched out for a little rest. A few minutes later, 3 burly men showed up and ordered me to my feet. If I wanted to lie down in this town, I'd have to pay. I've never been back to Chicago. After 3 days of my enlightened presence, Terence's friends were very eager to see me go. Terence went back to Denton, and I got a ride from a spaced-out Swami Rama devotee to Dad's home, now in Danvers. He was appalled to see my shaven head and single backpack, and his anger grew during my visit as I described my new philosophy. Meals were very tense. He would say things like, "What kind of slop do you want to eat now?" Anton had just graduated with his anthropology degree, which was almost as useless for employment as the composition degree would have been for me. His thesis was an incomprehensible string of jargon-laden sentences about cargo cults. He lined up a job painting a house for the cheapest homeowner in Beverly Farms, a stockbroker who hitchhiked to work 20 miles away in Boston. Anton paid himself $7.50 an hour, his sister Rose $5, and I got $2.50. His rationale was that my work would be inferior, although we hadn't done any painting yet, and in the event my work was just as good as theirs, I decided I had no other opportunities, especially with a bald head, and wanted to spend the summer with my friends. At the same time, I felt ripped off. This was not the last time Anton would take advantage of me. About this time, Anton picked up a gray-bearded hitchhiker. After some conversation, it was clear the new friend would appreciate some acid, so Anton gave him some. Turns out, this was Harold Humes, who went by the nickname Doc. This was not from a doctorate, although most people thought so, especially from his claims to have been a professor. The nickname was from Doc Hewer, a character in Buck Rogers comics he read in high school. Doc went to MIT for a short time, left school, and later completed a bachelor's degree at Harvard. He was an accomplished writer in the 50s and early 60s, completing two novels and co-founding the Paris Review in 1953 with George Plimpton and Peter Matteson. The CIA funded the new literary journal as a cover occupation for Matteson, but this wasn't known until 1966. Doc didn't need this to fuel his paranoia. In the 50s, he had over 1,000 pairs of shoes and was considered a charming and brilliant eccentric. In fact, he had a much deeper mental illness, but fit right into the artistic community, where such things do not stand out from the norm. Doc was campaign manager for Norman Mailer's run for mayor of New York City in 1960, and was present at the party where Mailer stabbed his wife Adele, ending his chances at the polls. After planning to live in a hollowed-out ox carcass, Doc designed and built a paper house for low-income housing, which he set up on George Plimpton's family estate on Long Island. His brain was insured for $1 million. In 1964, Doc wrote Bernoulli's Epitaph, a cosmology based on a spherical vortex. I read and studied this paper, especially as macrobiotics talks a lot about spirals, but could get nothing useful out of it. Doc lived in London in 1966, part of the hedonistic and self-destructive party scene then in full bloom. Timothy Leary was a good friend from Doc's participation in the Harvard psychedelic experiments, and he gave Doc a very large supply of LSD. Tim thought that almost anyone could benefit from acid anywhere at any time. This was a disastrous error. Schizophrenia, and sometimes other severe mental illnesses, are almost always worsened dramatically by tripping, sometimes permanently. This was the case with Doc. He required several months of institutionalization in London after a psychotic break, and would be in and out of hospitals and jails from then on. I visited the Unidentified Flying Idea in Cambridge, one of Doc's main hangouts, which was a free massage co-op, giving what they thought was shiatsu and the like. A large poster of Mao Zedong graced the wall. Doc considered Mao to be a good candidate for the second coming of Christ, and listed all the reasons, which, thankfully, I cannot remember. Anton thought it plausible. As Anton and I stood outside the center, a car swerved out of the traffic and came toward us. We scrambled to one side as it plowed into a car parked by the curb, with various car parts flying in all directions. The driver got out of his car very groggy. Doc said, and all but I agreed, that this was due to beamed microwaves. Government agents wanted to destroy the clinic by blacking out drivers who would drive through the front wall. Later, he looked to the sky, saw an airplane with a flashing light, waved, and said, "Hi there. Thanks for the support." Clearly, he was lacking his body armor. Doc had small, enthusiastic groups of student followers at Harvard, Columbia, Princeton, and Bennington, and would bum a place to sleep and hang out at these campuses. Anton and I visited an apartment where several Harvard students gathered with Doc, with the inevitable cloud of dope smoke. He held court quite convincingly, although I only bought a fraction of what he said. I'm embarrassed that I believed any of it at all. He was convinced that lenticular clouds were a recent phenomenon that UFOs used as both heat sinks and shields to avoid detection. From time to time, he would claim that agents were going into and out of the next room to change surveillance tapes, and you could almost see them if you smoked hard enough. People stayed away from the windows to avoid the microwaves used to control our thoughts and sap our will to resist the FIDO's subterranean government computer network. He described how Jimmy Carter would send a limousine at any moment to pick him up so that he could come to the White House and give his sage counsel to men of power. And what Anton liked the best, Doc said that he was Socrates in a past life and Anton had been Plato. They locked up Socrates for corruption of youth too, didn't they? My not smoking put me out of range for most of these delusions, and I was held in some suspicion as a result. Was I one of us or one of them? Only in this crowd could I pass for a normal. Anton, Rose, and I finished the painting job, and life was not easy with Dad. After a brief stay in sweltering Denton, Terence traveled to Nova Scotia to join Ken Moorhead, a fellow macrobiotic Dentonian. Ken was a fine percussionist and was struggling to have a career in music. On their way south, they stopped by to say howdy, and with about 5 minutes' notice, I joined their road trip to my hometown. I forgot about my quest to go to Peru. We drove through Manhattan, shouting out our windows, "Labor Day earthquake!" But our timing was mistaken. Denton again, fall 1977. I became roommates with Terence, sharing half of his duplex and paying $40 a month rent. Our landlord's name, and I'm not making this up, was Phil T. Luker. He was in his early 70s and had fled the Weimar Republic during the hyperinflation of the 1920s. We had no air conditioning, relying instead on evaporative coolers, even though our climate was too damp for them to be very effective. With constant 100% humidity, all our papers curled and mold was everywhere. Terence refused to use insecticide, and the roaches took over. We tried boric acid powder and keeping our food sealed and dishes clean, but it didn't matter. My futon was on the floor, and I would wake up with roaches on my lips and eyelashes searching for water. Finally, we resorted to weekly attacks with a vacuum cleaner, filling the bag each time. Some of my stray possessions, such as my instruments and papers, that had been scattered hither and yon, came back together. I set up my electric piano with headphones so I could compose without bothering others, and got back to practicing violin. In November, I started my first work for soloists, chorus, and orchestra, a setting of the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit. I'd kept up my bhakti yoga, pranayama, chanting, and meditation, even though this was considered dreadfully yin in macrobiotic circles. Dorothy moved into my apartment on Fry Street next to Flo Hospital when I left town, and soon after, the house burned down. She lost all her paintings and possessions and had to start over from scratch. The first order of business was to find work. A shiny bald head was a hindrance, so my hair grew back. I relied on my trusty 10-speed bike for transportation, so employment had to be local. I joined the crew painting the inside of the old Denton County Courthouse. This is a massive stone structure built in 1896, and it will probably last as long as the pyramids. Our plucky team consisted of a 62-year-old boss about to either retire or fall over dead, whichever came first, and about 6 young people scrambling to find work. Something about painting leads a man to alcohol, and our boss was clearly a lifelong drunk of the affable variety. He was quite wobbly on his feet and not terribly motivated to overachieve, which suited us fine. The sooner we finished, the sooner we were out of a job. We bought each day's paint in 1-gallon cans and poured them with due deliberation into the smallest roller trays we could find. Working around the lawyers and judges and other riffraff was handy in slowing us down. Starting in the basement, we had to paint the walls of the rooms housing the large volumes of county records. The boss said, "Don't bother moving the books, just paint around them." One can imagine what the reaction would have been when the volumes were moved a few months later to the new courthouse. So we went ahead and moved the shelves and contents before painting. I met Rufus, the chief of maintenance, who was also 62 years old. He was the first black man allowed to have a telephone in Denton County back in 1940, because a prominent white man swore to his reliability. He showed me the old segregated bathrooms in the basement, no longer used. The white bathrooms were just as you would expect, with doors, sinks, and individual private stalls. The black bathroom was simply a wide part of the hall with a toilet. No doors, no privacy of any kind. The drinking cup for blacks to use was smeared with tar to keep it separate from that for whites. I found it hard to believe, but there was the toilet. Rufus understood our pace of work and said that before we painted his room, we would have to wait for the right phase of the moon. I continued my interest in the Illuminati conspiracy, which now is quite embarrassing, but seemed plausible at the time. After compiling a great deal of information and speculation, I gave a talk early in the fall at Bruce Hall on the subject. Two men in the back, dressed in trench coats, drew my attention, and at the end of the talk I made clear that I wouldn't repeat the act. They seemed relieved and left, one less nut to monitor. Part of this talk was about international fugitive Robert Vesco, whom I figured was portrayed in the Illuminatus trilogy under the name Hagbard Selene. No one else thought so, but it seemed obvious to Anton and me. Hagbard / Vesco was supposed to have a penchant for white luxury cars, especially Bugattis, to complement his stolen nuclear submarine. A little while later, I was loitering outside the Infinity food store when a white Cadillac pulled up with a driver and a passenger. The passenger leaned over and shook his finger at me, smiling, and they drove off. He looked exactly like Robert Vesco. I have absolutely no explanation for this whatsoever. After this experience, I dropped the whole Illuminati thing and went on to other delusions. My hair was still short, and I required a lot of coverage to protect my poor pointy head from the tropical sun. I'd inherited an old silk scarf my brother used in magic shows in the early 60s. The scarf was probably 50 years old and was a 48-star U.S. flag. I wore it on my head with a headband. Naturally, I thought nothing of this, since plenty of Republicans did much the same, including Nancy Reagan. But as I walked to the store one day past the movie theater, an attendant ran out, clenched his fist, and shouted, "How dare you wear the flag! I'm going to shoot you!" I blew it off as more Texan bluster. After I was in the store a few minutes, a policeman came in and asked if someone wearing a flag had come in. I produced the antique scarf and explained that it only had the 48 stars, and there was no ordinance against wearing a flag. Plus, wasn't threatening to murder someone a touch more significant by way of criminal activity? The cop didn't care about threats to kill me. One less hippie, don't you know, and let me off with a warning. In December, we finally finished painting the courthouse, and the city had us do one more job, the county jail. There were only two bullpen-style cells, already overcrowded, and as we painted one of them, all the inmates had to crowd into the other, standing room only. They were not happy campers. Our old friendly derelict boss was replaced by the officer in charge of the jail, and he treated us as if we were criminals. I lasted one morning and quit. But my living expenses were so minute that 4 months of minimum wages gave me enough money to go 3 months without work, which I valued much more than financial security. So, back to the music. Winter and Spring, 1978. A macrobiotic woman named Barbara came to live with us in return for cooking, and screened off a few square feet of our living room for her bed and few possessions. She cooked in a very orthodox manner, salty and too long, and it was a struggle to get her to loosen up. I started feeling pain in my hips and lower back again, only this time it was worse and didn't go away. Salt made me quite ill with stiffness and muscle spasms. Some of my muscles never relaxed and remained fully contracted for years at a time, finally becoming calcified. I used ground ginger in hot water soaked into cloths and applied externally, which helped a little. But I was at a loss as to what was going on. I was getting more and more exhausted with normal activity, and resting didn't help much. Barbara cooked bread just as we did, which was much like the bread we sold in the store. Others might be tempted to use the loaves as construction material, possibly as fire brick, or maybe ballast. Our ideal was to produce a texture and density that defied the efforts of knives to cut, teeth to chew, and intestines to digest, since we were tough guys eating tough food, real youngsters. When our guts responded with pain, we knew we were on the right track, since this was called discharge. In fact, when our food made us sick in any way, it was discharge of toxins. Although we didn't know what the toxins might be, and could never detect any actually leaving our bodies. Sterling Proctor, macrobiotic French horn player and founding member of the brass quintet Les Beaux O's at NTSU, recruited me to play the violin part in Stravinsky's L'Histoire du Soldat. I was working on that, the Bach solo sonatas and partitas, and my two solo violin sonatas, when Barbara came to my room and said, "What is that music you were playing?" Happened to be one of my pieces. "That's the worst thing I've ever heard," was her review. Oh well. To avoid the flack, I took my violin to the International Order of Odd Fellows Cemetery, not far away, to play for all the dead folks, which is most of the classical audience anyway in our brave new world of pop music. There I encountered chiggers for the first time. For all you northerners out there who have not had the pleasure, come on down south some moist spring, and lay down on the grass in a shady patch for a while. An unseen army of microscopic vampires will latch onto your most tender areas and send you back north of the Mason-Dixon line right quick. Terence and I held classes in macrobiotics using space at NTSU. I put an ad up in the Infinity Food Store about helping people remember their past lives. A 19-year-old fellow named Randy responded. From our past life sessions, or attempts at them, and attending our classes, he got involved in macrobiotics. He's all better now. Turns out, from multiple investigations, that a number of local friends in the Denton macro community had lived about the same time and knew each other in Japan during the 1400s. We all ended up in Denton at about the same time, and after a bit, most left to other adventures. All the decisions we thought we were making and various life dramas that put us in the same town at the same time were actually coordinated at some other level we knew nothing about. In my case, I had to turn down Harvard and get booted from Eastman in order to end up back in Denton. I wondered how many other decisions in my life were of the same type, not really made the way I thought they were at all, but instead guided by much larger patterns of karma and unfinished business. In March, I completed the pencil draft of the Bhagavad Gita Chapter 1 for chorus and orchestra and showed the score to Anshul. He was impressed and asked me to write a 10-minute piece for orchestra, which he would commission. He talked my price down to $100, which would almost cover the paper, ink, and first couple copies of the score. This was my big break, although he didn't want me to mention it to anyone. I got to work arranging one of my solo violin sonatas into my Symphony No. 1, In Memoriam George Ozawa, and gave it to Anshul in October. However, he didn't pay me the money, which I desperately needed. When I sent him a note reminding him, he replied with a check and an angry retort. That was my last income in music for 30 years. Despite his promises, Anshul never read through or performed the music. A few of the local macrobiotic folks were even more strict than I was and paid the price. Two of them were down in the 80-pound range, and you could see all their bones. In time, both started eating more sensibly and regained weight and health. One, named Gwen, started going out with Terence, and eventually they were engaged. I did a past life session with her, and she remembered being in a German concentration camp, which is about what she looked like when I met her. After she recovered, she was quite a lovely woman. After a dozen years of boat dreams, I now lived 350 miles from the ocean and felt quite desiccated. I bought the cheapest boat on the market, an inflatable vinyl kayak, and got a ride with Ken Moorhead, who was driving to Wichita Falls. He left me off on a wild stretch of the Red River. I inflated the boat and threw it off a small cliff, followed by my gear, then scrambled down to get in, careful to avoid the nearby water moccasin. That night, I pitched my tent on a sandbank. Sometime after dark, I was awakened by what I thought was a woman being raped very near to my tent. I couldn't make any sense of it. When I left my tent the next morning, I saw pug marks from a mountain lion nearby. The wonderful world of work! By spring, I had to look about for employment again, and after quite a bit of looking, found a job as a busboy in a local pizza inn. My fellow workers found my whole existence enigmatic, especially my bizarre food choice. A sizable chunk of the minimum wage paycheck was automatically deducted in the assumption that the workers would eat some of the pizza. I didn't, but had to pay anyway. When one of the bosses found out that I didn't eat there, he got offended and huffed, "Don't you like our food?" To which I had to reply, "Well, I don't eat tomatoes, white bromated flour, spices, preservatives, vinegar, cheese, sugar, soft drinks, canned food, anchovies, meat, commercial salt, or green peppers." This left them confused as to what I did eat, especially when I said whole grains and vegetables primarily. Almost no one knew what whole grains were. One young lady, whom I overheard criticizing another for, quote, "not speaking no good English," unquote, asked, "But where do you go to eat? Burger King? No, you can't go there. Jack in the Box? Where do you go?" They couldn't grasp the idea of cooking for yourself. What they could grasp was the tips, of which I got no share. Exhausted after 2 weeks of this, one night I dropped a tray of beer mugs and they fired me. The old music building, where I had my first lessons at age 3, had seen better days. A piano's legs punched through the floor, and that was the final straw. They demolished the older portions of the building and built new all around what remained. I went down and applied to be a He-Man construction worker. I must be a tough guy. I ate macrobiotic bread. What could possibly go wrong? As I had no particular skills, they set me and a co-worker on a large pile of rocks and said, "Move it over there." This was not my finest hour. The boss figured that the best motivational tool for getting a skinny weakling to haul ass was to scream in his ear. I lasted 2 days. Broke, I applied to Manpower, which hires out day labor. I called in early each morning to see if there was a job available. I had one assignment, scrubbing out the inside of a filthy oven. After I had worked about 5 hours, the woman who had hired me came in and said that she would rather have a woman do this work, so I had to leave. She knew that if she fired the worker before 6 hours, she wouldn't need to pay anything to Manpower, so she did this a lot. Then I got sick with a cold and couldn't work for 2 days. After that, Manpower didn't want me to call anymore. I got a job at a local furniture store, but after a few days they saw that I had little ability to move furniture in and out of trucks. Next, I signed on to a 2-week trial period at a nursing home. I found myself force-feeding meat to old people who were struggling against it. They would bend the spoon in their mouths to keep the food out. Although they wanted to die, we forced them to keep living. People would come to the home, usually with most of their wits about them, but in a few weeks they usually fell apart. One woman didn't want us to get her out of bed in the morning. She would scream, "No, no, 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 no," until we tied her in a wheelchair. Then all day she would repeat, "I want to go back to bed. I want to go back to bed." Ever since, this has occasionally been my mantra as well. Then, after we finally did put her back in her bed, she would say, "Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you," for a couple of hours until falling asleep. Some patients were violent, and others were comatose. I had a very hard time lifting the dead weight of a 250-pound man up in his bed, much less into a tub. The more artistic patients created abstract expressionist works on the walls with their own excrement. Being that close to such intense suffering took its toll on the staff, most of whom said they would commit suicide when they turned 65. All my co-workers were women, although a man was in charge of the home. During a break, I overheard some of them talk about me. They held me in extremely low regard, since I was physically weak, and said some very cruel things. At the end of the trial period, I was called in to see the boss, who said, "The 2 weeks are through, and so are you. maybe you can find a nursing home with lower standards. His former job was as a minister. I was already familiar with the lack of divinity in our divines. While working at the nursing home under the delusion that I had a regular job, I got the idea of making a small cruising sailboat to live on. The plan was to launch in the Gulf, then cruise along the coast, playing my violin for donations. To see what that would be like, I tried busking in Denton. I had learned 4 of the Bach solo sonatas and partitas, and had 2 solo sonatas of my own. Over the course of a week, I performed in and was run out of all the prime spots after an elapsed 3 hours of music. I averaged about $18 an hour, but it was extraordinarily hard work. Still, the dream persisted, and I gathered plans for a 16-foot sailboat. I was lucky to have Randy as a friend. His grandfather had recently died of dementia in a nursing home, and left some apartments to his mother up in Stratford, Texas. This little town is right at the top of the Texas Panhandle, next to the border with Oklahoma. If you ever need evidence that the universe is geometrically Euclidean, a visit to Stratford will convince you of space-time flatness. The apartments needed maintenance, and so Randy and I went up there for 2 weeks every month. Usually, the tenants had been illegal aliens who were hard on the housing and frequently left quickly from fear of arrest and deportation. We would find beans still on the stove. The work was hard, but we didn't have a boss yelling at us and could do as we pleased half of each month. We did have police, though. They didn't much like the idea of strangers from out of town. One day, Randy and I were shopping at the hardware store when 2 cops came in and slapped handcuffs on me, reading me my rights, but didn't mention any reason for the arrest. They hauled me down to the station and interrogated me for a while, finally saying there was a man going by the name of Jim Robinson using a fake credit card. His description was 5'3" tall, black hair. I guess they thought I might be using trick shoes and a wig, and was too stupid to keep my first name straight. The local agriculture was a nightmare. People tried keeping gardens in town, but it was a futile gesture. Plains sprayed herbicides and pesticides on the surrounding fields and bathed the town in poison, killing anything people planted except grass. There was a massive feedlot upwind of town, where thousands of cattle spent their last few months living on several feet of manure crowded together to fatten up for slaughter. The carbon dioxide released producing meat in this manner far exceeds that from all transportation combined. Most of the employment in town was to support the feedlot, and our neighbors were cowboys working there. They would spend most of the day injecting the cattle with antibiotics, hormones, and other drugs to keep them alive under such unnatural conditions and make them gain weight faster. Someday, when we have an epidemic, those antibiotics will be useless, but nothing can be done due to the political power of agribusiness. At night, a choking brown fog surrounded the street lamps made of acrid manure dust. The whole scene depended on diesel pumps lifting water from the Oglala aquifer at a rate of over 100 million gallons per square mile per year. This water dates from the last ice age and before, and could be completely gone from this area in 25 years. The locals couldn't get enough of this hell. After a full day in 100-degree heat, these guys came home and practiced their roping skills on bales of hay on which they'd attached plastic cow heads. Then they'd get in their big cars and ride up and down the one road in town, making as much noise as possible, burning up that cheap gas for kicks. Barbara left for Vancouver in early summer and we were back to cooking for ourselves. My weight was now down to 112 pounds, and I was quite worried about it, as my strength was very low. I tried all kinds of dietary adjustments, but with little effect. Finally, in desperation, I included small amounts of fish, yogurt, and cheese. After several months, I got up to 130 pounds, but my more orthodox friends disapproved. Any difficulties or illnesses could now be blamed on the wider diet and my lack of self-denial. After many days over 100 degrees, Randy and I were more than eager to get the hell out of Dodge. He had an old BMW sedan he'd fixed up, and we took off from Stratford in late July. We stopped in Denver to visit my sister, who was living with other members of her Astro Institute. I think Rama Adonis had recently died, and the group dissolved soon after our visit. Then on to Wyoming. Yellowstone was booked up, and we hadn't made any advance reservations, so we were stuck driving through without stopping. As we arrived late in the day, we drove through the park, through the moonless night, missing almost everything. This was quite hazardous. Steam from geysers drifted across the road, lit up by our headlights, so that from time to time, visibility went down to about an inch. It was as if cardboard suddenly covered the windows. I had admired and studied the works of Edgar Casey for many years, and so was curious to check out Livingston, Montana, just to the north of Yellowstone. Casey said that Livingston would be an important city after the earth changes he predicted. We camped for a week on the Yellowstone River just south of town and got acquainted with the locals. There was a Casey study group that we attended, which was a center of activity for the local New Age scene. Many were anticipating a reversal of the poles, although there was that pesky matter of conservation of angular momentum. Randy and I were so burnt on Texas that we were thinking of buying land in Montana. We took a tour of properties with a local real estate agent. He pointed to a teepee on a hillside where a woman had given birth during the previous winter. There wasn't much level ground, which was a relief from the plains. Randy and I decided to climb a mountain and picked the relatively modest one of maybe 9,000 feet. We got an early start and got to the top about lunchtime, but the path down was rather more exciting than we'd bargained for. We came down a scree slope made of small bits of shale. After we'd gone down at 100 feet or so, we realized the surface was extremely unstable. Standing was impossible, so I got on my back and figured I'd ease my way down. When I moved my hands or feet, rocks under me would dislodge, which would dislodge rocks just above them, which would dislodge rocks above them, and so forth, until I was hit by rocks coming down from above me. There was some serious nail-biting until we got free from the scree. The growing season limited agriculture to hay and cabbages, more or less. They'd had a killing frost in early July. The people were a whole lot tougher than I could ever hope to be. The females were especially different. I was used to Southern belles, who were not in evidence here. Just wading in the river up to my knees in the first week of August was unbearably cold. We decided to try for a milder climate, for the native women wear halter tops. Some friendly fishermen gave us several trout they'd caught near our campsite. We had the fish heads in our cooler when we came back through Denver for another night or two with my sister. I decided to make some improvised fish head soup, the sight of which nauseated the Astro Institute folks. Turns out, eating it nauseated Randy and me as well, and it took a day to recover. Back to Denton, where Anton came through town. He was involved in a gold mine in Nevada, and when possible wanted me to come out and join in. I was game, but wary of worshipping gold, which, after all, is just a kind of rock. But Anton was enthralled, and the chase for gold and power became the major theme of his life. He mentioned casually one day that a mutual friend thought that cocaine was the perfect drug. I thought that was absurd and dangerous, since cocaine was just about the worst. I should have picked up that he was using it himself. Thankfully, his schemes didn't work out, and I remained in Texas. With the apartment job over, Randy and I started refinishing floors. This was, quite literally, a daily grind. Randy had an early 60s Chevy pickup truck that we loaded up with rented equipment. I got used to driving this beast, which lacked such luxuries as speedometer or ignition key. To start the truck, I used a paint can opener in the keyhole. No car thief would think of that. More macroneurotica. Terence made plans to marry Gwen in January 1979. They would move into a house across town that she had bought, as her family was prosperous. I noticed some strange changes in his character. When I'd first met him 4 years ago, he was cheerful and had an easy laugh, with a glint in his eye left over perhaps from those daily acid trips. Over time, with macrobiotics, he was getting tight, rigid, and more secretive. One day, he said quite unexpectedly that it was silly to make any promises, since it was impossible to know that you could honestly live up to them. I didn't know what to make of that, especially since he was about to take wedding vows. In October, I noticed an old 18-foot mahogany Chris Craft motorboat on a trailer in the street. It was in terrible shape, with 6 inches of soil accumulated inside. I asked if it was for sale, and the owners were happy to let it go very cheaply to avoid having to dispose of the carcass. Thus, I encountered yet another of those dreaded opportunities for growth. This was a planing hall, totally unsuited to what I had in mind, but I figured with a full keel, some ballast, a Chinese junk rig, and a cabin, I could have myself a sailboat, miso sloop. It was all planned, with a balanced rudder complete with trim tab for easy self-steering. I'd studied junk rigs for some time, including during my visit with Paul, where I went to the Library of Congress and found a Chinese librarian who had waited a long time for someone like me to show up. He was delighted to hand me the 3 books about junks, which were worthy of his pride. With a Chinese lug rig, I could use cheap materials and have a sail I could control and reef from inside the cabin. Besides the total hopelessness of the hull design, I had neglected to do my homework with regard to rotten wood. I thought I could just chisel out the soft parts, fill in with thickened epoxy, and be good to go. I didn't realize that fungus tendrils stretch a foot beyond the obviously rotten parts, and that the boat was fit only for a Viking funeral pyre. It was just too entrancing a project. I gathered local bamboo and made the battens for my 200-square-foot sail made of scrounged cloth. At the first real blow, it would have ripped into ribbons, but mercifully it never got the chance. I built up a mast glued from pine boards and used a draw knife to make it round and tapered. For the keel, I took similar small boards and glued them together, and much the same for the elaborate rudder. Unfortunately, I had neglected my homework on the glue as well, and used carpenter's wood glue, which was not waterproof for prolonged submergence. So everything would have fallen apart. It was February 1979 when I finally realized that this was yet another folly, and I sold miso sloop to people who wanted the trailer, flat tires and all. I figured there would be other lost causes to apply myself to. there was a significant result from this misadventure. To busk with my violin up and down the coast, I needed music to play. So, in January 1979, I started a cycle of 64 movements in 21 sonatas for solo violin. Each movement corresponded to a change in the I Ching. It took about 5 days for each piece and 2 to copy in ink, so that by June I'd finished 18 sonatas, about 3 hours of music. In the fall of 1978, Terence told me that there was a very interesting veterinarian in Dallas, Norman Ralston, who had cured his terminal cancer with macrobiotics and used similar dietary treatments with acupuncture on the small animals in his clinic. He was setting up a seminar for Michio and Evelyn Cushy in late January. Terence, Gwen, and I got involved and got to cook for the Cushys during their visit. This was quite an honor for us, and we had the opportunity to spend some time with both of them. They were so charming and charismatic that they could have said anything and we'd have believed it, and that's just about what happened. Michio gave a lecture about the 5 elements and how they relate to our internal organs in a cycle. In his thick Japanese accent, he went organ by organ and then asked the audience, "What comes after the spring?" I whispered to the person next to me, "Summer." One thing he mentioned got me thinking. He was a soldier in Japan near the end of the war, stationed in the home islands, and said that he admired the martial spirit and feeling of unity the Japanese had then. It seemed to me that this martial spirit caused one of the cruelest disasters in the history of East Asia, but I kept my sentiments to myself. The interest stirred up by the Cushy visit led us to plot the formation of the North-South Macrobiotic Center to be located in Dallas. Norman bought some land with a house and a barn on the eastern edge of Dallas and gave me $50 to start up a newsletter. This was a series of dogmatic diatribes that I hope will never be excavated from the landfills where it so deservedly rots. Shortly after, Terence and Gwen got married at her parents' home in Fort Worth. At the wedding, I played my 3rd solo violin sonata, which was dedicated to them. They moved into Gwen's house, and I got another roommate, Earl, also a macrobiotic. He was friendly and easy to live with and worked with disabled children. A week or two afterwards, he mentioned that 1 week a month, one of his autistic kids would live with us. This was interesting news, but I figured, what the heck? Turns out this 10-year-old was quite a handful. Sometimes he would throw uncontrollable screaming fits and be quite violent. From the pallor of his skin, you would think he had been entirely drained of blood. His speech was echolalia, repeating bits of what he heard over and over, kind of like Philip Glass. The doctor thought autism was a food allergy, so we would have to prepare just one food at a time when he was with us. 1 week, it was broccoli. Another week, it was elk meat from wild game shot in Yellowstone, and so forth. None of it worked. Dorothy, after several traumatic misadventures, was continuing in school and living with theater majors. This was an exotic bunch. One day when I visited, a roommate was wearing underpants with a purple cape. Purple? Really now, there's such a thing as taste. I needed a cover for my Gita piece and gave Dorothy a copy of Back to Godhead, the magazine of the Hare Krishna movement. There was an illustration of Krishna showing his divine form to Arjuna, which was just right for my cover. 2 weeks later, Dorothy quit school and joined the Dallas ISKCON Temple. I was apprehensive, to say the least. Founder A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada had died the previous year, and all sorts of nasty power plays were afoot in the political structure which would last a decade. Membership fell by more than 90%. Later, we learned that the boarding school for devotees in Dallas was the scene of severe child abuse, which nearly ended the movement after a lawsuit. People thought that by being devoted to Krishna and chanting, new converts would be pure and trustworthy. Didn't work out that way. But Dorothy, now with a devotee name, was blissed out and busy working on artwork for the Dallas Temple. She did a splendid job, but others took the credit as she was a mere woman. While there was a lot of elaborate singing and dancing, the focus was on the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Along with the other devotees, she chanted 16 rounds of the Maha Mantra a day, with each round having 108 repetitions. This was one of my favorite mantras, but that many repetitions would have driven me nuts. The temple had separate sleeping quarters for women that were decidedly inferior to the men's. Her vermin problem made my battle with roaches look petty by comparison. One night, exhausted after her daily labors and chanting, she was trying to sleep while the ceiling collapsed on her. It had been weakened by rats, and now she was covered in the scurrying beasts and their feces. She and the other women were not shy about bringing this to the attention of the temple leaders. We hadn't had a meeting of the members of the Infinity Natural Food Co-op for some time, so we gathered together with Humble Self, wielding the gavel as president. There was some concern about our legal status. Terence had started off as an equal member of the co-op with the special task of storekeeper. He had done so much of the daily oversight of the store that we all just let him run things. We didn't understand that he didn't like the government, and especially didn't care to pay taxes. As is usual in such cases, he was happy to reap the communal benefits. He just didn't want to pitch in. We had not yet registered as a non-profit organization, which would exempt us from income taxes. We hadn't registered at any kind of business, which meant that we all shared liability for the store's income taxes as cooperative owners. Terence always paid the state sales tax, since that was something regularly checked, but he had never paid any other kind of tax, personal or corporate. In fact, he didn't have a Social Security card or a driver's license, and on closer inspection, he didn't do any accounting and kept no books apart from a file of odd receipts. Money simply accumulated in the bank, up to about $14,000 at the time, which was supposed to be owned by store members. About $3,000 was designated for projects to benefit the natural food community, although nothing had ever been done. Many members, including me, voiced alarm and insisted that we immediately register as a non-profit before serious problems came up that would close the store and get us all in trouble. Terence agreed, and we believed him. Trusting Terence was a big deal for me. We had done a long series of guided meditations. They started off as research into past lives, but one day a powerful being calling itself the Source barged in and we began channeling. I had no experience with this kind of thing, but had done a good deal of reading of Edgar Cayce and others. A few channelers seemed legitimate, most did not, and the information was rarely of any use. Generally, it was the Space Brothers Say to Love One Another kind of thing, not exactly big headline news. I was tired of the impracticality and unreliability of this kind of research, and wanted what similar researchers have needed for a very long time, a mechanical instrument that would interact with other planes. Then the whole area of transcendental physics could actually be a science instead of this strange and usually bogus conglomeration of some fact and mostly imagination. I knew beyond doubt that other planes existed, from extensive personal experience. I realized that knowing about all the planes and their interactions was fundamental to a better understanding of most of the big philosophical and physical questions. The first reading with the source gave the basic design for an interactive device that I later called the Oracle, and later readings with Terence and others helped fill in missing details. All I got were general design parameters, and I had to figure out how to build and run the device. Terence had a booklet written by Ray Stanford, who operated the Association for the Understanding of Man, AUM, in Austin. He had done what appeared to be good quality channeling in response to a request from a physicist for cosmological insights. The ideas from this article, combined with what the source described as the wave matrix theory, dominated my research for the next 11 years. I neglected to do any research on Ray Stanford himself. During March, while practicing my violin, I noticed that my neck would become very painful and stiff, and the muscles wouldn't relax. Then my hip problem came back, alternating hips. Slowly, pain and stiffness spread all over my body until any movement was with great difficulty. Soon I had to buy a cane to get around, and life was a nightmare. Sleep was torture, as lying down and getting up were major projects, and turning over required great effort. No dietary adjustment seemed to work. Plus, I was almost out of money. Fortunately, it let up a little for a week, during which Randy and I refinished the floor, but soon I was crippled up again. While I was wondering how to support myself, I pondered the possibilities of a chain litter and what angle I could use to make it profitable. Finally, I came up with a strange name chain litter, which implored the addressee to go to a library, find a fat telephone directory, and copy down the addresses of the strangest names he could find. Then he was to run off copies of the letter and send off to as many as he liked. This was to help make balance for the prejudice suffered by people with unpronounceable names. Some of the 80 letters I sent went to Arlen Aardvark, Dora Egsfrisdotter, Arnett Klapsaddle, Emilio Zoykuk, Insti Pop, Joseph Nutsukuku, O. Anschlickler, and Igor Zygote. Fortunately for my depleted karma bank, no one responded.